So I have the great honor to introduce Dr. Chen, a very impressive and lengthy bio here, which you can read, but I will just note a few highlights if anyone's not familiar with her. So did her training for MD at Einstein, continued an additional professorship and research at Dana-Farber and Harvard and was the science director at the Belfer, which I didn't actually know, and was the founding chair of the Department of Genomic Medicine at MD Anderson. And, you know, a big area of interest of hers is kind of this translational genomic medicine, but even more important to that, kind of the underpinning idea of kind of integrating all the different modes of information, whether those are purely scientific, clinical, academic, and industry. So the idea of being able to lead these kind of collaborations and integration of both organizations and information to, at the end of the day, hopefully improve patient management is, I think, what it's all about and what she'll be talking about, at least in part, in the keynote today. So, Dr. Chen, thank you.
Thank you for that introduction. I'm going to try something new. Well, maybe not. Okay. I wanted to, somewhere in the middle, I supposedly plan to do a live demo, but my computer's not coming on. If that doesn't work, I'll show some screenshot, because I think sometimes it's good to actually show not just a PowerPoint, but the tool itself, and I don't know why I can't, it's not, it seems to have locked down, but I restart.
Keep talking.
Okay, well, so much for setting it up in advance. Now my computer seems to locked up, but I'm going to start, and I'm going to try to give you a summary on some of the things we've been doing the last couple of years, thinking about how we can use technology and data, really thinking about impacting on patient care and management. I'm not going to, for once, today I decided I'm not going to cover any scientific data at all, and really just talk about the work we've been doing in technology development and implementation. I'm going to start by... No, that's good. No, the slide's good. I'm going to start by sort of summarizing a little bit some of the cumulative lessons that we have learned over the last couple of years as we do this. And which is probably obvious after your conversation yesterday, is we are looking fundamentally at a flawed system. It's a provider-centric, sick care system. And I put it in this context at the corner of, bottom corner of this larger grid to make the case that the way our healthcare system currently is set up, where's the pointer? There's no pointer. Okay. Is that over the years, it's built to be really a place where you go and seek care. So if we think about chronic disease, and you heard the summary from yesterday, we begin to think about cancer ultimately becoming a chronic disease. It is really not a system that is good for managing and keeping the patients healthy for as long as possible, rather than just a system that get them well or get them better faster. And so therefore, in this sick care setup, it is episodic by definition, is reactive, and it's always about where the providers are. And that is a challenge because I think, well, this is what I meant to use, we can't just focus on increasing the efficiency of this system as we look at the challenge facing us, the $3 trillion challenge that we're dealing with, which is absolutely unsustainable, is that the world has changed. This system might have been great 50 years ago when the major mortality in the world is infectious disease, for example, acute illnesses that we die from. But today, we're suffering primarily from chronic disease because we've gotten better. Thanks to hygiene, thanks to antibiotics, we're living longer. We're now succumbing to chronic disease, and the system is just not amenable to it. On top of that, we know medicine has evolved. You heard a lot about it. Just think of how quickly and how rapidly checkpoint therapy is taking over in our thinking about managing patients. In those few years, that speed of development in our knowledge and the best way to treat patients create a major barrier to keeping that knowledge up. How do we disseminate and ensure that best practices are actually adopted out in the community setting where majority of our patients are diagnosed and treated and managed? And then, as I already mentioned, the medical needs have changed. We're really being challenged and burdened with chronic disease rather than acute illness. Lastly, the economic is such that we have to think about solution that is not just based on cost. If we think about the $3 trillion, and there are a lot of statistics out there, and it's been said that a third of it is waste, where does the waste come from? Well, the waste definitely come from inefficiency, and we're all well aware of that inefficiency. But that is, I would argue, the smallest part of the buckets in the waste. The second bucket of waste, which is much bigger, I would argue, than inefficiency, is suboptimal treatment of a patient. When you have a therapy that you know could be curative, but the patient didn't get that, instead their disease progressed, that is a much bigger waste. It costs a lot more, not just in the direct cost of care, but the cost of society and human suffering. And then the last, I think, waste, the biggest bucket of waste, is getting sick in the first place. How do we keep people healthier longer? How do we improve their quality of life? And the sick care system is fundamentally unable to deal with the challenge of prevention and early detection and screening. We can try to do it, but it's never a system designed to do it. It would never be a system that can effectively deal with that. All right, I'll try to do this. So I'm going to... Apology. I probably can't do two things simultaneously. I'm just going to weigh on this one. So you have heard a lot about the concept of genomic-based therapy, and certainly over the last decade, we have learned that when it comes to targeted therapy, based on the genomic, we need to know that there is a target, and we need to have the drug that actually works against their target, and we need to have a way to identify the patient. And it's only when we have all these things together, whether that identification of the patient is inclusion or exclusion criteria or biomarkers, I think the idea is that we need to enrich for that responding population. And we only see clinical efficacy and success when we have all of these things together. And that certainly, we have seen some exciting proof of concept over the last decade, such as BRAF inhibitor, and that certainly has motivated these large-scale national and international efforts to characterize the cancer genome as a first step to identify additional target that we can develop drugs and biomarkers for. And then this is the International Cancer Genome Consortia map, sort of outdated, probably a lot more than the number we're talking about here, but this is generating a reference cancer genome that allow us to begin to translate that into target. But at the same time, I would tell you, and you're well aware, that we know the genome isn't everything. Certainly there's increasing interest and effort in epigenomic. And so you can now imagine the complexity of data that we've been dealing with the last decade, where you have somatic alteration, copy number, nucleotide mutations. You also have to now deal with expression changes. We begin to think about non-coding RNA. We incorporated in TCGA targeted proteomic profiling through RPPA, and we know the epigenome is coming online, and the possible combination of how these alterations impact on the output of that genome is stunning, and I think analytics is going to be a big component, and I will make the argument again later that we really can't understand what this genome is telling us without having the phenotype along with it. Because by simply studying the genome in that de-identify as a reference set, we're always going to miss what it means. So what I try to set up, as I'm being distracted here, is to make the case that, coming back to the point about the waste I mentioned earlier, the one of the biggest ways is indeed this knowledge gap that's widening. The more we see success in acceleration in advancing our knowledge, developing new therapy, new combination paradigm, the wider that gap is between what's possible and what's actually being practiced out in the community. And that knowledge gap is because our practicing oncologists and physicians really would not have the time to be practical and realistic about it, to keep up with the knowledge base and be able to use the information that they're, you know, facing in a way that they can use for the patient in front of them. So I think we need to think about how to bridge this gap, because otherwise the 87% of patients that are not treated in academic institutions will not be getting the latest and best therapy. And that's a big waste and a cost to their health. And this is actually a recap of something that from the summary from yesterday that we just heard earlier actually already summarized this point. We know that the problem with cancer is increasing both from the cost and the demographic perspective. And certainly these new therapy themselves are expensive. They require tests to go along with it, not just biomarker tests and maybe some imaging tests, but also when the practicing physician don't know how to use these drugs. That lack of standard, lack of evidence base, use or not using these drugs is also a major problem. So all of these tells us that we need to think of new solution to address this problem. And the first thing that we really have focused on at MD Anderson is thinking about how to create a system that allow us to have an efficient way of driving adoption of the latest and best care, evidence-based care. And the way that we thought about that is building a cognitive clinical decision support system called the Oncology Expert Advisor. And the idea is, let's create a digital system that has scalability, because people-to-people transmission of knowledge has limited scalability and fidelity, for that matter. And given the need to drive the adoption from center of excellence, where these research and new trials are being done and a new paradigm being developed, we have to have a more efficient way of doing that. And that's our effort on College Expert Advisor. Now, I'm going to give you a just highlight, and if possible, I'll show you a demo, if I ever can get in. It is the capability of the Oncology Expert Advisor. When it was designed, I envisioned it to be simulating the second opinion's expert consultation experience. I remember the day when I was in practice, what do? You pick up the phone, hopefully you have the number of the right expert, and you say, hey, I have this patient, this is what I know about them. What do? So the first thing we try to build into OEA is the ability, using language analytics, to read the medical record system and generate that summary. That sort of put all the historic and relevant data together. And particularly important as we look forward, when we think about chronic disease patients that have very long medical record history, you probably want to focus on the relevant information and make sure that you don't miss anything as you evaluate the patient. Once you say that, then the experts say, well, in my experience, based on what I know, this is things that you should consider doing. So the second part, capability of the Oncology Expert Advisor, is really providing that evidence-based recommendation. And part of this is also being the up-to-date knowledge base, so that it captures the latest literature, so that it provides the latest evidence. So you can imagine that using a system like this, with every new therapy option that gets developed or new combination strategy, Expert has a way of incorporating that knowledge into a system like that, and anyone who have access to OEA will now be able to see that recommendation and see that as an option being presented. And then it's important, however, and I have many of these conversations with the payers, they are very interested in the second part because they want to enforce and encourage adherence to evidence-based care pathway from a cost containment perspective. So They are always interested in having cost being one of the evidence included in this recommendation. But drug cost at the decision point of choosing which drug is not the total cost of care. That's just one decision out of 100 that we have to manage when the patient is sick during the episode of care. We need to optimize management. Just think about the toxicity, the adverse event. Is the experience of a specialist, the intuition, the art of medicine really comes in knowing how to manage the patient most optimally when they're on therapy so that they get the maximum benefit of the drug and minimize the adverse events. So we begin to also build into OEA this idea of care pathway, starting with just making available at the fingertips known adverse event you should look out for even before you consider the therapy, and certainly adverse event that we should alert you to during the process when the patient is on therapy. And that being the first way of trying to help support a physician who may be using a new drug for the first time because that just got approved 2 months ago and he or she is seeing the patient for the first time. So these are the things that we try to build into it to support OEA, to support a physician. Now, this is how we train the OEA system. Designing the core capabilities simulate that experience of second opinions from an expert. We train it sort of similar to the way we would train a fellow, which is the future generation of experts. They come with knowledge from the book, from their training, and then they see real patients, and then they, work with the attending faculty who sort of tell them, no, that's not what I would do. Follow me. So over time, with every case, the fellow begin to learn not just what the book knowledge might tell them, but what the expert actually would do, and they themselves, through experience, become the expert. So OEA was trained in a similar way. The Watson underlying core engine ingests the body of literature that's relevant, as well as the textbook. And, for example, in this case, the NCCN guidelines is a starting point for cancer therapy. And then we expose the system to historic cases, real medical records where they, train the system to read it and summarize what each medical record represents and what the attributes that are relevant. And then that go into the learning algorithm, the machine learning pipeline to sort of iterate to generate recommended therapy. And then the experts say, the clinical champion said, nope, that's right, that's wrong, I would have done it this way. And it's that iteration that allows us to increasingly improve the recommendation. And the hope is, once we train that, the system becomes infinitely scalable. And they can serve as a virtual expert that can be available on demand 24/7 to a general practice oncologist or to a specialist who is not specializing in that particular tumor type, or anyone who feel like they wanted to get access to the latest literature in an area that they feel like they may need need to be updated. So with that, I'm going to try to run the demo. I think I finally log in. Can you switch me over? Oh, so I have just logged in because I didn't want to deal with this. I'm running a live demo on the actual database in through the VPN into the firewall. These are the patients that actually have consented. So I can't show you everyone, even though it's running in the live database and live code, because these are real data. So these patients actually consented to allow their medical record to be shown in public demo, but we did change their names and we changed their photos. So you're not seeing everything, but every other data point is real. I'm just going to show you one patient, and I'm going to show you about our solution on molecularly targeted therapy. This is a solution that focuses on providing decision support for genomic-based and molecular-based, which is immune checkpoint-based therapy, with the idea that that's an area of gap in knowledge for most practicing physicians, because many of them were trained before the day of DNA or targeted therapy or immune checkpoint therapy. So we want to use this as a way of showing it. This is a lung adenocarcinoma patient. What you just saw was actually the OEA extracting information, and all the summary information I'm showing you here, most of it is extracted through natural language processing from unstructured text in the medical record, such as summarizing what the status of that patient is, their current medications. I will show you, here's the diagnosis, you know, sort of, actually, you can't see this, but on the live system, it will show you this original source documentation, which obviously I'm not taking you to because that will have the real patient's name on it. One of the things we do is that we interpret the genomic testing report so that we present that data and it makes it easier to access, including different tests. So, for example, this patient is out negative in terms of by cytogenetic and transfusion on the translocation, but certainly have EGFR and PVD3 mutation, for example. I'm not going to show everything because I think there's a time limit to what we're doing here, but you can certainly also look at the longitudinal history of the patient. In this case, showing you, for example, that this patient was initially diagnosed and put on treatment and was considered in remission in October. And then the latest workup show that she's progressing. And the progression, in this case, we are building at MD Anderson a centralized facility to do rhesus measurement called the Quantitative Imaging Core, Quantitative Imaging Analytical Core, CIAT. And the idea is that we need to standardize that whole process so that we can have confidence that we can use the objective measure as a way of assessing response or lack thereof of a patient, not just a patient on trial. Obviously, that's traditionally done for a clinical trial patient, but we're trying to do this for standard care patient as well. When the patient is presented based on the attribute, they will recommend standard therapy, and for example, in this case, these therapy are considered high confident because they are the right. Well, we can go look at it, and we'll show you, you know, the eligibility, why the patient is considered qualifying for that particular therapy. But coming back to one of the important points is, for a physician who's not experienced in using the therapy, we want to make available to them all the available information on toxicity and adverse event so that they can be prepared, even just thinking about it or discussing with patients prior to putting them on therapy. And this is last part is, I think, a very interesting and potentially one of the most powerful piece as we think about how to improve deployment of these drugs to the right populations. What this is showing is in our database today, and this is just the lung cancer clinic over the last 3 years at MD Anderson. So, you know, we have that many number of patients that's been put on this therapy. And what it's showing you is the profile of the actual adverse event that we have in those patients, either abstracted from the laboratory result or from the clinic or nurse's notes, versus what you can see from the label. Obviously, this is what's reported out there, but this is the actual population of patient that you're treating. And most of these patients were treated prior to the CIAT core was set up, so they don't have rhesus measurement. So that's why we don't have the data populated on this side of the graph, but we hope that as we make that a standard, that every patient will have rhesus measurement, then we'll be able to actually have an objective measure of response, even on patient on standard care therapy. And the idea is that you can now start to ask whether there's a difference in the population of the patient. They look more like your patient. So this is a first step. Not at all personalization yet, but it's segmentation to give you a better sense of the patient of the same gender or same race. Do you have a different profile in response when we begin to collect that data, or equally important in adverse event? And from choice of decision, and this is one discussion I had with lead newcomer, for example, is we can't just focus on the cost of the drug itself. In making decision, we have to think about total cost of care, which means the profile, adverse event. for that patient or in population that look like that patient becomes a very important parameter. But we need to have a system to collect this information first. Right now, I would tell you, we know for a fact that we don't have enough data, but we know we can collect this data. Well, we know that if we can collect and aggregate this data across the community and the institution, then we actually have the power to do some of these analysis. I think I'm going to switch over just because of time. I don't want to spend more time. Oh, I did want to point out that if you saw it, there's a clinical trial. It's very important that we sort of make the case that every patient, we try to screen and match them to available open clinical trial, even if there are standard of care available, because the speed that these new trials are coming along, the investigational protocol of yesterday becoming standard of care tomorrow, I think it becomes very important for us to offer the option of clinical trial to patients, not only to give them an alternative, perhaps, that could save their life, that have better outcome than the standard of care available, but also to increase the number of patients participating in trial as we think about the need of these participants for combination trial that allow us to assess how we can optimize different combination or sequencing of multiple drugs, and that becomes important. So we want that to become available. And similarly, when you go into this trial, if they're open label trial, we can allow the clinician to actually see upfront what the adverse event and tox profiles are. It is an important discussion point in talking to patient about whether he or she wants to participate on a trial. Okay, let's just move on back to the slide. So I gave you an example of a technology that we've been working on and thinking about how to use technology and create the data to address a perceived deficiency in our current care system. And one can think about that for many of the other area. One of the things is we know that just because, and I show you our solution that focus on molecularly targeted therapy in supporting use of genomic information, in order to make a decision about choice of a targeted therapy. But we know that the genotype, all the diagnoses together, is not equivalent to the phenotype. We know that this is a plot on the BRAF inhibitor study showing that even of the 80% of patients that respond, they don't respond similarly, even though they all have the same mutation and they all have the same pathologic diagnosis in terms of the cancer. And that shouldn't be surprising because we know that the mutation is one alteration in the somatic cancer genome. And we know, and this is just one circus plot showing that each genome had many alterations, and only one of them is the BRAF mutation we just looked at, or the targeted mutation. And we also know that this tumor cell doesn't grow in isolation. It actually interacts with the stromal, the microenvironment. And the importance of that is recognized, well recognized, given the efficacy of immune checkpoint therapy, for example. But that's not it. Let's not forget all of the somatic genome really work in context of the germline genome, at least the germline genome, because we know there are inherent susceptibility and variation in individual that impact on risk of getting disease and certainly behavior of that disease, how aggressive, how benign, how likely it's going to have a tox event in response to a particular drug. And that is a common, it sort of aggregate through its exposure to the environment and their behavior. And we certainly appreciate how much of our behavior influence our health. And it's the aggregation of all of that that generate the phenotype we observe. So therefore, we should never expect that a single mutation in the cancer genome will tell you that that's a responding patient. We should never expect it, so we should be very grateful and surprised to see actually the kind of response we get. But to get to the next level, which is getting better at identify the truly responding one and excluding the one that wouldn't respond, or the suboptimal responding one because they need a different combination, we're going to need to get to understand the rest of the data, because this is probably what the pathway actually look like inside the cell or inside the patient, rather than the very nice diagram that we like to use in our publication and in the textbook. So how do we get there? How do we get that information to begin to identify additional attributes of the patient in addition to their genomic alteration that dictate the response to the therapy or adverse event profile to the therapy? We need to have phenotype data, and we need to have it in a longitudinal manner, not just a snapshot, because a snapshot doesn't tell you everything. The one platform that we built at MD Anderson over the last 2 years is what we call the Apollo platform, which is a longitudinal platform to collect serial biopsy from patients and generate serial molecular profile data. And the idea is creating an environment that allow us to integrate research in context of clinical care, but not in the critical path of the care, which I feel strongly about, because science is not medicine. They're not the same. So what we try to do in the Apollo platform is try to standardize the process of collecting serial sample from the patient, generating molecular phenotype data on every patient before you even have an idea of what the question you want to ask are. This is about creating that big data resource to allow you to generate hypotheses rather than having an hypothesis and trying to generate the data. But in order to do that, in order to begin to have a way, and this is just a protocol, for example, that's operating for the last year or so in melanoma clinic, where we are serially, we're approaching every patient and serially collecting sample from them who are being put on clinical trial or standard of care for either targeted or immune-based therapy. And what we then want to do is have this be a standardized process with consent already in place. So the next person who wants to ask a question that can use the data, and these data will be linked to the full clinical records of these individuals during, prospectively, during their care. They can start their investigation of their hypothesis, hopefully starting from the data, rather than starting from the process of getting a consent and then trying to accrue patient and then trying to generate data. That long process of 80% of work need to be standardized and streamlined. And just think about from a clinical trial perspective, many of you are from pharma. This gives you a platform to actually think about that true smart clinical trial, pharmacogenomic-based clinical trial, without all the delay and concern that usually go into designing the trial. How long will it take me to get the consent? How many patients will be willing? And what's the quality of the biopsy? And who's going to generate data? Well, what we hope to create here is a clinic where every patient, well, actually not every, we know the percentage of consent. For example, when we did this in leukemia, it's 75% consent rate. And you know the cohort and the makeup of that clinic populations. Now you can begin to imagine designing the trial. And you know every patient has serial data points on the sets of data linked to full clinical information, not just the extracted clinical annotation from your clinicians who are running the trial for you, which are always delayed because there's a time lapse to doing that manual curation. So we're hoping that infrastructure like this, it's infrastructure, it's not science, it's infrastructure that we put in like this will allow us to imagine executing this trial, potentially many more of these trials, such as combination, much more efficiently, and allow us to maximize the patient population. You can imagine that the small percentage of patients that has out-translocation in the lung cancer clinic, well, instead of having to test 100 patients to get that 2 patients or 3 patients, whatever the latest statistics are, since every patient is being tested and molecularly phenotyped, the patients that don't have that mutation can now go into other trial. And there could be an economy of scale in sharing the cost in generating those phenotyping data. And then one important requirement that we build into the Apollo process is that all the data will go into our institutional centralized big data platform, which is linked to the clinical data in real time, so that for these research data, you have the ability to ask a question based on how they respond clinically, and that give you, and not just the annotation, but the actual records and all the lab results that the patient would have, all the imaging study, so that full annotation on the clinical side, I think, enrich the research data and allow you to maximize the potential value you can get from that research data. Now, We are building this in leukemia, melanoma, and lung, and trying to expand that internally in MD Anderson. But I would be the first to say that as big as MD Anderson is, there will never be enough data points for you to have the kind of power that you would like to have. So we need to begin to aggregate more. And for that, we begin to look toward taking that model out into our MD Anderson network, putting that technology infrastructure on the cloud and start connecting data, not just the way we connect internally where we pull all the clinical data, all the patients from not just one clinic but multiple clinics and aggregating them in our internal big data platform. We want to do that across our network. Now aggregating data for multiple of our partners and eventually beyond the network. And to do that, we need a much larger technology infrastructure to support that. And with that, we, over the last year, have really began this alliance with several major partners, including IBM and PricewaterhouseCoopers, who's really leading the management of the information interchange, which is the cloud-based analogous entity to the institutional big data, as well as AT&T in providing us that Internet of Things connectivity to devices, as well as, importantly, security and bandwidth of the underlying network. Because if we think about eventually truly practicing telemedicine as mainstream, PHI data and communication in motion need to be regulated and protected, not just these data in at rest in a database, which clearly is regulated by HIPAA. So the ability to tap into a telecom communication group that have the infrastructure and the infrastructure to provide that level of security and compliance is necessary for us to truly practice telemedicine. And the reason we need this is we can't just push out using a system like OEA, push out knowledge to help standardize care and support that. That's important. We talk about that being a major area of cost, contributing to the cost of a healthcare system. But very importantly, we need to learn what happened to this patient out in the community, because we are all well aware that the population of patients we see at an academic medical center is not representative of the general demographic out there. And if we have no access to how the general patient population responds and we can't accrue them into our trial, then we're doing our investigational clinical studies in a very biased population, and the ability to generalize those conclusions to the general population is going to be much lower, and therefore the value of those studies is lower. So if we can broaden that and have access to, you know, patients in real-world environment and their response, efficacy and toxicity profile, that gives us a richness of the data that currently we do not have. And that's the reason why we're building the cloud infrastructure. So I'm going to now try to wrap this up. What I've tried to tell you is I started by making the case that our current healthcare system is a sick care system. It's very limited to the bottom part of the grid that I made up that sort of represent the inpatient and outpatient setting supported by licensed professional staff. That's our traditional healthcare system. The work we've been doing at MD Anderson has been trying to think about how to optimize the utilization of resource within that environment. By resource, I mean when should the patient, how can we support, let's say, a general oncologist that's in a secondary care setting to optimally manage the patient so that not every patient needs to be referred to a specialty center. And how do we do it in such a way that we ensure quality? Because lack of quality leads to poor outcome, and that's a major cost. At the same time, we know that if we think, go beyond cancer, really think about chronic disease, we need to have a system that manage them and support them in such a way to keep them healthy so they don't come to the system, like even a clinic or a hospital. And for that, I began working with the UT system and thinking about a project that I call Project DOC, Diabetes Obesity Control. And what we want to do is take that infrastructure and that approach to population health management. thinking about how to create a extended healthcare system that actually is much more patient-centric. In fact, I call it consumer-centric because we hope to get to them before they are patients. And what I'm showing you, filling out the rest of the grid, is on the x-axis, thinking about how to extend the reach to the consumer so that we broaden the access point to care services. They shouldn't only get care services at a place like clinic or hospital. They should be able to get access to care services at ancillary sites. And in particularly, the ancillary site that I obviously am very, that you will be familiar with is retailer. Our consumers spend a lot of time in retail sites. Why can we leverage those? And certainly CVS and Walgreens of the world have shown us that they have a way, and that's a good place to access their consumer. And ultimately, it should be anywhere. We all carry our mobile devices around. We don't leave them. They don't leave us. We do everything else on it. Why not supporting healthcare services? On the y-axis, we also have to expand. Think about expanding our workforce. What I talk about, empowering maximal capability of a generalist with specialty expertise through OEA, is a way of really expanding their workforce. But we can go beyond the licensed professional. Ultimately, it's the do-it-yourself mentality that the millennium is so used to and expect today on everything else except healthcare. Actually, that exception is no longer. People are wanting it and people are doing it. So how can we help support them and enable them to provide themselves a certain level of services that really are about prevention, monitoring, and basic care, so that we can help them stay healthy and minimize them needing the acute services in the traditional healthcare setting. But at the end of the day, we don't want our consumer to think that they can stay home with their mobile phone and take care of their heart attack. That's not good either. So we also need to empower them. So part of that is education from a consumer. They need to know, and we can use a similar type of clinical decision support system, they need to know when it's okay to manage a condition on their own, when it's okay to go to a Walgreens clinic or a Walmart clinic, but when do they need to go to the emergency room. And knowing the right care services for the right medical needs absolutely necessary to ensure quality. Otherwise, we'll end up being wasting as well. So the diabetes project really is thinking about taking that same infrastructure that I've mentioned to you, supported with a technology partnership, but engaging really starting the viewpoint of engaging the consumer first, but not forgetting that all the technology, all the new care pathway that we can imagine won't do anything unless our community and care delivery system adopts it. In other words, our physician, our clinic, our hospital, our clinic need to embrace it. And we need to engage the new entrants. The technology partners are a new entrant, but retail, I already mentioned, is another one that we're focusing a lot on. And at the end of the day, the risk-bearing entities have to acknowledge the value. And the major risk-bearing entity, obviously, is the payer. So we're designing this project and engaging all the stakeholders in the ecosystem to try to deliver a different set of capability to manage chronic disease. And to put it, you know, sort of simplistically, what we want to do is use technology to support the patient as much as possible to keep them healthier, keep them from needing acute care, so that we can try to not to push the care out, but keep patient healthy so they can monitor on their own, so they can do some of the lifestyle modification outside of care environment so that they don't need to use the acute care facility as much as possible. And from, again, recognizing that none of this is going to take hold, we need to make sure that the payers appreciate and agree with the value we create. And there, certainly there's a lot of data out there, payer pilots that have proven that if we can shift some of these care outwardly, outside of the emergency room and hospital, it definitely reduced costs. But the caution I put on the very top is we have to make sure that we only do that at the time, and when we do that, when we push and enable these care services outside of the hospital and clinic, that the patients are actually improving in the outcome, because we don't want to simply deny them care that they need and while their status deteriorates. So it's important for this new care system to work, that we have a different way of measuring and rewarding these services. And the only thing at the end that counts should not just be the best practice, which we focus on, which is necessary first step, on the provider side. It really should be measured at the level of the patient in terms of the health. And from a population health management perspective, we also have to acknowledge the health status is not just a physiologic measurement. There are many lifestyle and social parameter and behavior parameters that go into influencing the health. And we have to have a formula from a health economic perspective to allow those to be addressed. I'm not suggesting that the healthcare system need to solve or can solve social problem, but we need to have a way, smart way, a new way of from a reimbursement point of view, to say it is cheaper for me to give this patient $20 or pay for his $5 medication than pay for his emergency visit. How do I make that happen? Because that's actually cost saving to the payer, that is healthier for the patient, and better outcome for the society. So what is that reimbursement payer model that allow me to do that and be smart about it? And that had to be part of the equation. Otherwise, just the technology, just changing behavior is not going to be sustainable in the long run. So I'll end with this slide by saying that I think the opportunity in front of us from a technology and data perspective is it can be the disruption that allow us to change our health system. By having the technology to change our monitoring of the patient from a snapshot to frequent, continuous, ultimately real-time monitoring with all these exciting wearables, that would give us data that's no longer discontinuous, but not just longitudinal from a healthcare data perspective, but contextualized. By that I mean not just the health information, but also their behavior, their social, their personality, everything else about that that make that person a person rather than a disease diagnosis. That's contextualizing data. And then we can start building analytic to go from just diagnosing what's wrong to hopefully prognosticating and knowing what will happen with that patient so that we can be proactive in preventing and intervening. And so that the care that we deliver as a health provider is no longer reactive care, hopefully is proactive, and we all want to ultimately get to that preventive care. And I think that improved outcome will ultimately translate into cost, lowering the cost, rather than starting out with the focus on reducing costs, because I think that can lead us astray. And the only sustainable cost reduction on the economic end, I would argue, is improving outcome of the patients. I think I've already talked about this. I want to end with some acknowledgement. Certainly the work within MD Anderson, both on the Apollo Big Data and the development of the Oncology Expert Advisor and some of the associated technology, has been a cross-discipline collaboration that involved a lot of people, and I couldn't even possibly begin to put everyone in here. But certainly, in addition to our clinical experts, in the different disciplines, the operations side, both from information technology to compliance and regulatory to IRB, a lot of things that go into practicing medicine that we have to deal with when you're thinking about a technology piece to be implemented. It's not just an app on the app store, and you hope someone would download it and that will transform healthcare. That's not going to work. I also believe that we need to reach out and leverage what other industry have. As a care provider, as a care providing institution, our core competency should not be building technology. But instead, we should have partnership with those whose core competencies are building those technology and providing those infrastructure. But until we engage them and guide the development of those technology so that they work for healthcare, we will end up having something that worked great for the bank, and we try to fit it in and make it work for us. And I think that's not going to be to our benefit at the end. So we have been have great relationship with IBM on the analytic group, not just the Watson group, but the healthcare analytic group, as well as the cloud group that provide the infrastructure. With PricewaterhouseCoopers creating the information interchange that It's not just the technical infrastructure that allow for data aggregation and use, but the business process that needs to be managed, the governance that need to go into to ensure compliance and intended use. And then the network piece, which is very much the plumbing, the pipes, but it's important when we think about protecting our data emotions and the communication emotion. And finally, all the work that I've told you about today up to now have really been made possible by philanthropy, particularly from Mr. Joe Lo from the Jim Wild Charitable Foundation, who single-handedly funded this work over the last several years when it was purely a concept with absolutely no proof of concept to now, still very immature, very early on, but I think we're beginning to chart a path to make it work. Thank you.
A great talk. Thank you, Dr. Chen. Question. So one thing I didn't see directly mentioned was any partnerships that you either may have or may want to forge with industry, whether the likes of a foundation medicine, whether a biopharmaceutical company, or even the insurers like Aetna's and U.S. Healthcare, et cetera.
Well, I think on the technology development side, our partnership had really been focused on our tech partners in the tech core. But actually, more than a few of you have had conversation with me about potential relationship to help build and leverage the Apollo infrastructure and the big data infrastructure from an institution point of view, and thinking about how we can use that to accelerate clinical trial design and executions. I hope to have more of those conversations. In terms of the technology, like OEA in building a network that changes care delivery, our partnership, aside from the tech partner, have been other care delivery entity. So for example, with the diabetes project, I'm focusing on South Texas. So the federally qualified clinic down there, the regional acute care hospital system, those are the partnership that we're working on. So it really, I absolutely believe, and I think we need to have many of these partnerships. It's opportunities that either present themselves or we need to create because it's specifically on the path of what we're doing. But I welcome any and all conversations. Okay. All right. Thank you.